Welcome to the Infinite Consciousness This Week, and thanks for listening. Today we have with us Dr. Eve Wood, who is a psychiatrist, but not just a psychiatrist on the path of consciousness. Welcome to the show, Dr. Wood.
Thanks. I'm so thrilled to be with you.
Thank you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about you before we get into everything, just so people know who you are, where they can find you, and the books you've got out that they can go and get more information.
Sure, I'd be delighted to do that. Well, I'm an integrative psychiatrist, which basically means I'm a medical doctor who's committed to bringing together what I understand in Western medicine with many other complementary and alternative interventions and self-empowerment tools and mind-body medicine and the spiritual dimension in healing. And I've been in clinical practice for many years. I teach in the Integrative Medicine Program at the University of Arizona that was founded by Andrew Weil about 10 years ago. So I teach healing professionals also on how to do integrative approaches in healing. That's what we do through that program. And I started in the last several years writing books and doing other things to teach people how they can begin to implement these things in their own lives and what role a doctor might play and what role they can play in their own healing journeys. And I have two books that are out now. The newer one just came out a couple weeks ago, and it's called 10, the number 10, Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life, Overcoming Anxiety, Distress, and Depression Through Whole Person Healing, which I believe is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is called There's Always Help, There's Always Hope, An Award-Winning Psychiatrist Shows You How to Heal Your Body, Mind, and Spirit. And that's because I won 11 awards for that book, actually. And then, how to get in touch with me. Well, I have a website, which is www.drevewood.com, drevewood.com. And the books are available through bookstores or absolutely on Amazon. And if people go to my website, there's information also and a direct link. And they can also learn about my schedule and ask me questions. That's a free service and a free email newsletter, too, that they can sign up right on the homepage if there are questions about what we're discussing today or, you know, other questions as they read or begin to think about their own health journeys. So is that good enough?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, great.
Now, you don't know that I'm doing this, but I'm also doing this research project on consciousness.
Good for you.
And I've been asked, I found there's a linguistic problem there, you know, that different people mean different things by the word consciousness.
Mm.
So the word is used so loosely, nobody really knows what it means. So before we start, what is your definition of consciousness?
Well, I don't know if I could call it definition, but I can tell you what my understanding of it is.
What do you mean when you use
it? But what I'm thinking about, I guess, when I think about consciousness is our multiple levels of knowing, really. And a lot of my work is about how do we connect with our deep intuitive knowing. How do we connect with sort of those bigger spiritual unifying knowings that resonate with us and others in the universe in a bigger way? And how can we kind of move more and more into a place where we can take advantage of a lot of that real knowing in the service of our own wellness and making a difference in the world? So that's how I think about it. I'm not sure if that's what you're studying. But,
I guess the thing that started it was I asked a medical doctor what was his definition of consciousness.
Yeah.
Consciousness. He looked at me like I was stupid and said, well, the opposite of being in a coma.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
And so I realized then that there was just this huge arena of definitions or interpretations of what it was, and so nobody really knew what they were talking about when they used that word because they meant something different and didn't know that they meant something different.
Yeah. Huh.
Now, another thing I wanted to ask you about, because we're going to be getting into mind and issues of mind. Do you think the brain thinks, or do you think that the thinking is contained in mind?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, in 10 steps, I actually talk about sort of some of the brain circuits involved in aspects of thinking. I think there's an aspect of thinking that happens at a cellular level in our brain cells and in the way our neural circuitry works. But I also believe that every cell of our body has cellular knowledge and memory. And So I think it's, and that all doesn't happen clearly in our, what we think of as the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are different kinds of thinking, actually, and different kinds of knowing, and they don't all happen in the same place.
What would your definition of mind be? That's another question that, you know, when these, most of these people I interviewed have been physicists, and I'm trying to help them get some language to talk so they can build a physical model of consciousness. And one of the problems they have is, what is mind?
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a difficult thing to think about. I mean, I think in some of the simpler ways, really, I mean, the mind is the brain. It's where a lot of thinking goes on. But what I'm saying and what I understand in a growing way is that that's not the only place that that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the only way that it happens.
Do you think that brain interprets mind, maybe?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting because I'm more of an intuitive person in the sense that, I mean, I even talk about, like, in the first several steps of 10 steps, you know, what's the role of your story in making diagnosis, and why are labels and names important? And what I say there is they're only important to the extent that they help us figure out what might make a difference to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, to me, in my work and the way I do things, not that there's a, I mean, I think we all have our own ways, you know, that's where I live. So I'm working minute to minute with a person and sort of trying to sort out together with them what are the problems, what are the answers, what's the best path or the most reasonable way for them to proceed that's going to make the difference for them. And it's only by doing that over and over again that I begin to develop some understanding and concepts about what in general might make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't actually do a lot of defining. You know, I really do a lot more of kind of experiencing and then sharing the lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily focus as much on, and what should we call it? Although I know for some people that's the way they learn the lessons, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question before we get into
the book. Yeah,
I noticed that Candace Pert had written something on your book promoting it.
Yeah.
So I know you're familiar with her work. Are you familiar
with sure. I know Candace well. Yeah. Her book, her most recent book is published through Hay House, which is my publisher. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the work of Caroline Mace, too?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Good.
Well, first of all, one of the things is that through our publisher, we do these I Can Do It self-healing kind of empowerment weekends sometimes around the country. So we've been speakers together at various conferences. And actually, I met Candace the first time when we were both speaking at a Unity Church at a health conference, even before Hay House was publishing my books. So I've known her, not like that we're best friends, but, you know, we're traveling on a similar path and with a synergistic vision and mission, really.
Well, I'm curious, do you think that what Caroline Mace says is true, that each emotion stores in a particular part of the body and maybe each emotion causes one of those different neurotransmitters to be released?
I don't know that I agree with that, no.
What do you think about
that?
I
think it's much more interconnected. You know,
elaborate a little bit.
Well, every cell in our body has multiple capacities. And for example, just talking about neurotransmitters, you know, there are certain neurotransmitters that we understand, at least we think we understand, like serotonin, for example,
mm-hmm.
that may have a significant role in things like depression. Well, as it turns out, we have more serotonin receptors and more serotonin released in our guts than in our brains. So what does that mean? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just giving you one example, but our cells are, and our, so the bath that this, our cells are bathed in our system is I think very much more sort of connected than oftentimes we acknowledge. And, you know, there's another step in this particular book, 10 Steps, that's learn the language of your body and make friends with your inner healer. And it's about actually how can we begin to understand some of our own physical symptoms And how often are they manifestations of anxiety or stress or ways our bodies are trying to talk to us? And if we can begin to identify that language and respond, the reality is we can begin to change things that have been understood as, you know, just, I don't know, some skin condition or a gastrointestinal problem or even neurologic condition. So my experience is that these things, and this is my experience, of course, as a doctor and a therapist and a healer for many years, are very much connected. I don't. My experience is not that they're separated from one another.
How do you? I really want to talk a lot about depression tonight. Just maybe it's been put in my face a lot with people that I know and with my own self recently. It's kind of ironic that I have you tonight of all times.
Well, I'm glad to be here then.
How do you diagnose depression over events that are happening in one's life? How do you differentiate the two?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, the way you make, first of all, the diagnosis of anything in emotional and mental health, including depression, is on the basis of the individual's story. And our diagnostic criteria are basically a description of a series of types of symptoms that must be present for a certain amount of time and that are not accounted for by something else in order to make that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So for somebody to meet the criteria for a clinical depression, they have to either have a depressed or sad mood or a lack of interest and pleasure in their usual activities for at least 2 weeks, more time than not. And then they have to have, from a list of additional symptoms, at least 4 or 5 more.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things like significant sleep disturbance, appetite disturbance, memory disturbance, the lack of sexual interest and sex drive, feelings of excessive guilt and self-devaluation, maybe suicidal ideation or even plan, things like that. And you have to have a certain number of them to meet criteria. And then you have to also make sure, you know, when you're making that assessment, that there isn't something else that would account for it. So, for example, when someone loses a loved one, they will look oftentimes during the mourning and grieving process like they are clinically depressed. But it's a question of depth of a symptom and how long does it go on that helps us determine, you know, is this something that's a normal grief process, even though it's really quite overwhelming, or is it causing a greater degree of sort of life disturbance and inability to do what needs to be done, or causing a level of emotional distress that the person isn't able to do, you know, crucial things for their own wellness, or is it just not quitting or moving in a time that you would expect it to begin to shift? So does that begin to answer your question?
Now, when psychiatrists are diagnosing these depression problems.
Yeah.
Excuse me. How does one determine, you know, there's a lot of SSRIs out there.
Right.
How do they know which one?
It's a great question. You know, there in the book, after these checklists and so on that help you figure out if you might have a condition and whether you want to be evaluated for it, I actually specifically talk about should you take medicine? How do you know if you need it? And how do you pick the right one? You know, there are these specific questions and then the answers to them. So you're asking a really important and common question that many people have because, of course, so many people are taking these medicines.
And so many people start taking them and they get the wrong one and it doesn't work and so they give up and just think they don't work.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right.
So
here's the thing. Unfortunately, we're not great at predicting what medicine is going to work. So if you've suffered in the past from a depression and responded to a particular medicine, then you're at great likelihood of responding to that drug again. Not always, but most of the time. If that hasn't been the case, then oftentimes if a biological family member has responded to a particular medicine, you have a greater chance of responding to that one than another one. Third, sometimes we try to go by the types of side effects of that type of drug and your symptoms and, you know, try to pick one that might be a little better. But the reality is, the bottom line about this is that most of the medicines like that affect serotonin, that's what you're mentioning, and others for depression work more of the time than not for most people, but there's no way to predict which one is going to work. it's a trial and error thing.
What about, are you familiar with neurosciences, Inc.? They, you know, test your neurotransmitter levels.
Yeah, I'm a little bit familiar with some of these emerging, you know, study groups and assessments. And but the problem with a lot of it is, you know, it hasn't been studied enough, and it's not out there enough for us to really know how well it works and how does it compare with other things. So there are some emerging technologies that may prove over time to help us make better predictions.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not at the point where I could say to you, and we have them today, you know? I mean, we may be moving in that direction, but we're surely not there in a kind of a comprehensive way for the vast majority of people.
Well, there's one of my clients, you know, I'm a medical intuitive.
Uh-huh.
And, she's having terrible problems getting control of her depression. And so I suggested that she take that neurotransmitter test, and she talked to her doctor about it, and the doctor said, well, it's only about 50% correct. And so my response was, 50% knowing is better than 0% knowing. So why wouldn't you start with a test like that where you at least had some groundwork where you should start?
Mm. Well, I mean, I guess that's one way to look at it. But the other way is that, of course, that's about as good as experimenting with the medicine. You know, that's the reality. So, it's not something I'm not opposed or not opposed to, you know. I don't know enough that we can say. And I really often honestly think that if something, maybe this is related to what you're talking about in terms of intuitive understanding, you know, if something, you know, really draws you and it feels like, yeah, I think I want to pursue that and I'm going to have some trust or confidence in it, then there's a chance it might affect your level of response.
Mm-hmm.
I would be more apt to say honestly, well, I mean, if she's been having a lot of trouble, you're saying she's been on a bunch of different medicines,
mm-hmm.
or what?
Yeah? Yeah, she has.
Yeah. And what's happened? None of them?
Nothing.
Nothing. And is she seeing a psychiatrist?
Mm-hmm.
And is it somebody?
She has terrible, terrible depression, you know, suicidal thoughts. And so, I was just wondering if you had a test that showed whether it was dopamine or serotonin or.
No, we don't. And not only don't we, but usually our thought is that it's probably a mixture. And not only is it a mixture, but it probably for different people is affecting different numbers of cells in different areas of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean like totally opposite parts of brain, but within all of these diagnoses, you know, there's quite a range of types of symptoms, severity of symptoms, you know, kind of rate of onset, length of depression, and it probably has to do with how kind of unique and different each one of us fundamentally is from the other.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, the best interventions are long-term partnering type of interventions. It's very interesting to me because right after I wrote this book, I mean, it hadn't yet come out because, of course, this 10 Steps book just came out 2 weeks ago, but right after I wrote it and turned it in and, you know, they sent it off to the printer, a huge study was actually published in one of our main journals in psychiatry. It's called the American Journal of Psychiatry. And what it said was actually something that I talk about in the book, too. And that is that many, many people who had been found to be non-responders to medication interventions for clinical depression were actually turned into responders when they carefully documented dosing and side effects and monitored it really carefully over time and made the proper and careful adjustments until they arrived at the right
mm-hmm.
combination. And in this book, in the 10 Steps book, there are actually all these charts and tables that you can use to keep track of your target symptoms you know, the ones that we're trying to treat and the side effects and rate them over time so that you can use that type of information to partner with your care provider.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've always felt that that's what made the difference intuitively mm-hmm. from my work. And, of course, then right after I wrote it all up and sent it on, it's going to the printer, there was this huge study that actually showed that.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes, that's what makes the difference, actually. It's not so much, I mean, not that we would maybe someday have one, but it's not so much a test. We don't really have a test. But it is the really the informed partnering with good information and real good investment over time, especially in these intractable cases, to find what works just right enough.
Now, a lot of people think that you can just take one of those SSRIs or whatever it is, the supplement or whatever it is that you're
yes.
going to take, and that it's going to work within a few days. But that's not really the case, is it?
No, actually, it's not. On a rare occasion, and it does happen, people will find a very rapid shift in their mood. We're talking about depression now,
mm-hmm.
with a antidepressant medication. But by and large, it doesn't work that way. For the vast majority of people, it's weeks till they really feel a difference.
And is it something sudden, or is it just a gradual thing?
It's usually very gradual.
To?
Although, they will often have a certain moment along the way, or several moments, where they notice something very significantly different.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes that'll happen after, for example, other people are noticing certain shifts that they didn't recognize. So it's usually not like an on-off switch, like boom, you know, now it's different. It's more gradual. They have a little more energy, you know, they're doing a little more. They start to have a little bit more of a laugh in their voice every so often. You know, it's more like that, and then they start to feel it. Oftentimes, the feelings are the last thing to shift, actually. Oftentimes, some of those other symptoms will get better first.
Now, also, some of these medications have some pretty dramatic side effects, you know, like sometimes suicidal thoughts. What can you describe to the listeners? Because people, you know, some people don't recognize this, and they let the symptoms are subtle. You know, you subtly get those kind of side effects, and you don't realize it till it slaps you in the face. Can you explain some of the how these subtle symptoms of side effects present themselves?
Yeah.
So they can learn to recognize
well,
that.
I encourage people always, you know, that's why these little charts to fill in and stuff, to start to pay careful attention to their minds and their bodies, and really notice if there were things that begin to shift for the better or for more challenge. The issue of, you know, these suicidal thoughts and are they made worse by medicines or not and so on, it's an interesting and tricky kind of question. I mean, definitely there will be a subset of people that have some thoughts that they didn't used to have, and you have to be very wary of that. On the other hand, statistically, we definitely have seen a dramatic decrease in actual suicide with the use of these medicines. And when there was a significant cutback on the use of these medicines after some of those warnings, we saw an increase in suicide again, especially in teens. So does that mean that some people aren't having the opposite effect, though? No. I mean, I think that it may very well be that for some people, there with a medicine like this, there may be the emergence of some suicidal thoughts or ideas that they didn't have before. Now, of course, for any given individual, we don't know for sure if it's a progression of the illness or not, obviously. But here we are in the moment, we have to make the best of trying to figure it out. So absolutely, if you're taking these medicines and you begin to notice the emergence of some of these worrisome thoughts that you didn't have before, that would be really, really important to share with your care provider. In the clinical studies where they were actually looking at whether there is an increase of suicidal thoughts and ideas, actually, some people began to have those symptoms, they actually right away made changes in the drugs. And in the studies, nobody actually killed themselves or hurt themselves. But they, you know, they did pick up on this and make changes.
What causes that to happen?
Well, you know, we don't know. But if you think about it, you know, the way our brains and minds communicate is by these neurotransmitters, these chemical messengers. And, you know, when we, our thought is that when they're out of balance or out of whack enough, sometimes we can be unduly depressed or anxious and so on, and that sometimes medicines can help with that balance. But again, you know, these medicines are affecting these neurotransmitters all over the place. So maybe sometimes what they're doing is creating a different balance somewhere for some person that has an effect you don't want it to have.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the whole notion of side effects, and I talk about this in the 10-step book, is that, you know, we're putting a certain medicine, and by the way, this happens with Tylenol or, you know, any supplement you would take too. This isn't just medicines of prescription, but we're putting something into our systems that we are trying to take to affect a certain thing we want to change. But the thing we're taking doesn't only go to that area. It goes everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it causes all kinds of stuff, some of which we may like and some of which we may hate.
Right.
And that's true for everything that we take, you know, some, you know, medications, whether they're over-the-counter or prescribed, a lot of things you can get now in a health food store and so on, you know. So we're not targeting really the areas that we want to affect and only those areas with our medicines. They go everywhere.
Mm-hmm. How do you know how much is enough?
Well, that's a question I ask and answer a little bit too in the book, and the way I think about that, honestly, is it sounds so ridiculous, but it's true. The amount that works is the amount that's enough, and I mean, in a way, it's common sense. But what that means is that I always start relatively low in dosing and go slowly because I want to find a dose if I'm using a medicine that will help the things I am trying to make better without using more than I might need, because the more I use, the more likely I might also be to get those, quote, side effects that I may not want to have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really by watching the individual response very carefully to find the right amount that's more helpful than harmful.
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
You know that depression is both situational, or can be situational based and physiological. But what about people that have ADD and ADHD? Is that also situational, or is that really a dysfunction of the brain chemicals?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
Well, it's an interesting thing. First of all, I will tell you that ADD and ADHD, it's not situational. I mean, people who have this diagnosis have this disorder and the way their brains work all the time. That being said, that doesn't mean they're symptomatic in every setting. So you can have that problem and have it interfere with your functioning in some settings and not others. But the setting doesn't create the problem.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it shows itself more actively in certain areas than others. So for example, I mean, I'll just give you an example of a kid. But it's true in adults too. But let's say a kid has attentional problems. Maybe that child is going to have a great deal of difficulty doing homework, but be a fabulous soccer player. And on the soccer field, they don't have any trouble concentrating
mm-hmm.
and playing well. And that can be confusing because a parent could say, well, my kid doesn't have any trouble concentrating, following through, knowing where to be, you know, being the best scorer on the soccer team. But in order to meet the diagnosis or criteria for ADHD, you have to have symptoms in two settings, but not every setting.
Right.
Now, with depression, with clinical depression, you know, if somebody really has a major depression or a dysthymic disorder or something like that, it's not caused by situation. However, if any of us are stressed enough by our situation, we could get tipped into a clinical depression. In other words, if we suffer enough loss and setback and trauma, we become increasingly more vulnerable to becoming clinically depressed.
Okay.
And different people have different vulnerabilities. So some of us might need a whole lot more stress to our systems to get depressed than others.
Do you have any suggestions? There is a lady that I promised I would ask you this question.
Yes.
Tonight. She has... it's the same one that I was talking about with the depression, but she
yes.
has probably the worst case of ADHD I have ever seen in my life.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And she hasn't been able to find anything to help her. Do you know of any things you can do at home, whether it's mental exercises or supplements or something that she can do at home to help make this better? Because she's actually been disabled because of it.
Oh, dear. Has she taken medicine for it or no?
Yeah.
And do they help at all?
Evidently not.
No. Okay. And she's had it since childhood?
Well, she does take Ritalin sometimes, and that helps when she's around me. She says that it helps her, but I can't really see the difference. In the
you can't tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
What is something she can do?
Sorry?
What is something she can do?
Well, there are several things, but the vast majority of people will get the most benefit from medicine, just so you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other things I'm going to say to you, I always recommend them anyway, even in addition to medicine. Okay, but some of the things that make a big difference with attentional problems is a very consistent structure, a lot of external support in the structure, so that, in other words, the things that the person needs to do don't rely on their own initiative and ability to follow through, because for a lot of people with ADD, that's difficult. So if they need, let's say, to exercise, which is, by the way, a fabulous intervention for anxiety, depression, and ADD, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They may do better if they have an appointment with a trainer or they get together with a friend to walk than if they just have to get out and do it. They're much less likely to do it
mm-hmm.
than if there's somebody they have to report to or do it with. I mean, that's one example. Another is the exercise. Another is some meditative exercises, meditation, you know, with guided imagery or CDs or something, has been actually shown, to, even in kids, to improve their attentional issues and not eliminate their need for medicine, but enable them to take lower doses of medication for attentional problems.
Interesting.
So these are some things. Also, some dietary things. These help, by the way, with anxiety, and they often help with depression, too. But it's watching carefully the amount of caffeine in the diet, because it can be stimulating in a way that can rebound.
Mm-hmm.
It's watching the sugar and carbohydrate content, actually, and trying to have more regular, consistent meals with healthy fats, including omega-3 fatty acids or fish oil, and adequate protein. Regularly.
What about E-tocopherol? Do they help that?
I'm sorry?
E-tocopherol?
Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Not to the same extent that I'm aware of.
What about the complex, the high-dosage B vitamins?
I recommend that people take the B12 and folate, but I don't usually recommend like mega doses of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So even the amount that you might get in if you take a regular daily vitamin and some fish oil, that probably would be enough.
Okay. What about bioelectric magnetic-based therapies, you know, like pulse machines? Do they help with that?
We don't have enough data to say they do. They might. You know, in the field of complementary and alternative interventions, and there's a step, include complementary alternative interventions in your approach in this book. In that field, there are five different domains identified, you know, different areas of complementary alternative interventions. Is one is the domain or the area of energy medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And what our national body says about this is that it may well be very powerful, but we don't have enough data yet to be able to say for sure go do this.
Have you used any of it in your practice?
No. I let me put it to you this way. I'm not an energy healer.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody I'm seeing is going for some other type of intervention like that or wants to and they feel it's helpful, I'm very supportive of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something I personally do.
Okay. Can you talk to me, you mentioned something in your book about the role of mind over matter. Tell me
yeah.
what you mean by that.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of ways, you know, that expression, we create our own destiny. And, you know, what we tell ourselves, both consciously and unconsciously, really affects what goes on in every cell of our body. So the more we can begin to call up into our awareness, really, some of the things that we're saying to ourselves, the more we can develop then tools and strategies to sort of change our inner dialogue and therefore our wellness and our healing. So a big piece of my work actually is helping people begin to identify what's going on in that inner world and what can I begin to do, what can you begin to do to affect it. So there are a series of steps in this book designed to help you access these different ways of being and thinking and how to work with them to change them.
Could you give us some of those steps now so people can understand it?
Well, one is, it's called identify the beliefs that imprison you and reprogram the brain circuits involved. And this has to do with sort of those learned messages often, you know, those things that we might have taken on from early childhood about, you know, you're not good enough or something, you know, let's say like that. And, you know, something terrible is going to happen to me or, you know, whatever, I'm not lovable, fill in the blank. And how then we carry that belief around both in our awareness and oftentimes in our, not in our conscious awareness, but we're enacting and living from that place without being fully aware of it. So I teach people how to begin to identify what some of those beliefs are, and some of them you may know immediately, right off the top of your head. And then I teach how to change them. And the way of changing them, basically, is by developing certain specific statements that are active, that are in the present, that make no use of the word no or not, no negatives, that basically speak to the negative idea. So, for example, let's say the ongoing belief is I'm not enough. The statement, for example, we could create one that might speak to that is I have everything I need. And now let's call that an affirmation. You know, affirmations are the things we tell ourselves. They could be positive or negative. I don't mean to affirm, but so this is a positive affirmation, right? So, so then what we can begin to do and what I instruct people to do is take that particular statement, that affirmation, the positive one, write it on an index card, put it on your bathroom mirror, read it over and over and over again throughout the course of your day. And of course you do it because you don't believe it, otherwise you wouldn't need to do it. And what begins to happen if we do that over and over and over again and stop ourselves whenever we notice saying the opposite, is that we literally begin to shift sort of that circuit of chemical communication in the brain and replace it with another one. And eventually we come to believe something else.
What about light therapies? What is the is there benefit to that? And if so, what kind of light would you use? I mean, if it's like wintertime now and the sunlight's, you know, not there, what kind would you use and how would you do it?
Well, it's interesting. It's very interesting. A growing number of studies now have been showing that. Let me say something else first. There's something called seasonal affective disorder. It's a type of mood problem that comes on for people who don't live in a sunny climate all year. And it comes on in the winter months when the days are shorter and there's less light. And it's a disturbance of mood. Oftentimes there's a craving for an excessive eating of carbohydrates. It's a very unsettling type of low-energy depression.
Mm-hmm.
And people with that problem have been found over the recent years to benefit very substantially from something called light therapy, where they get these light boxes, you order them, and you basically sit in front of, you know, you could be reading or doing, you know, whatever, watching television, that light box for a certain amount of time each day during those winterish months. And just by doing that, it affects certain hormones in a certain gland called the pineal gland in the brain, and it affects the mood. Well, it turns out that some recent studies have begun to show that even people who don't suffer from this seasonal depression can benefit from light therapy or light exposure. And even for people, let's say, with clinical depressions on medicine, light exposure with these type of light boxes, or, of course, if you live in the desert, you just go outside in the sun, you know, can, which is, of course, where I live in Tucson, that's all I need to do. But most people don't have that all year, you know. But anyway, exposure to light increases the rapidity with which they'll respond to the medicines for depression. So it probably is beneficial in a lot of other ways than what we've come to understand. And many people will say that, you know, they're more upbeat on a sunny day and more down when it's dark and gray.
What makes a lot of sense, I don't know if you've ever read the work of Fritz Popp, that he did a lot of research about and built some kind of special microscope where he could see the light that was emitting from cells.
Very interesting. And so he
proved that we're literally beings of light on the cellular level, and that the more light the biophoton put out, the more consciously aware the being, whether it was an animal or a plant or a human being, the more consciously aware that they are, the more advanced their consciousness. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
that could help.
Yeah, it does make sense to me. And, you know, I think it has to do with our, you know, word choice and language. You know, when we talk about being in a dark place and we're talking about feeling down, you know.
Yeah.
You know, or I'm upbeat, or, you know, if we just begin to look at our language, you know, a sunny disposition, you know, we're really using the notion of light and dark to describe mood, actually, very, very dramatically. So, you know, midnight of the soul, you know, or whatever.
Right.
I mean, we're, so on a very sort of intuitive level, I think we understand that there's some relationship between darkness and downness and light and some sort of lightness of spirit and joy. And it does make sort of a just intuitive sense that it would be tied in to the amount of light exposure that we have.
Now, another thing you talked about in your book was music therapy. Now, that, to me, that also makes a lot of sense because we are electromagnetic beings of frequency.
Right.
And music is
right.
Frequency, but I would imagine it matters what kind of music you listen to.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And it's not just listening. I mean, it's music in many ways. So it's music if you play an instrument. It's music if you sing. It's music if you whistle. It's music if you dance along to music and so on. So what makes certain common sense, and you're absolutely right about sort of what is the type, is that, you know, for example, if you're sort of down and dreary, then the most effective type of music activity for you would be either to sing along or play the instrument or listen and dance or just listen to music that is of an upbeat nature, and that is in terms of the pulse or the rhythm of it, the pattern of it, and the language, and the key that it's in, and so on.
Do the keys matter?
Yeah, it seems
found to be most beneficial.
Yeah, it seems to. So that, you know, as you listen to different music, I mean, you can tell very quickly, oh, that's happy, that's sad, that's energizing, that's calming, you know, by the beat of it and the note choice, you know, is it a major or minor? Now, minor is kind of down.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is, like, for example, with an anxiety management, you know, what you don't want something that's, you know, so upbeat and gets you jumping around. You want something that's going to be more slower and more rhythmic that will kind of slow, because your system will resonate with it. So you want something that's going to slow the breathing, slow the heart rate, you know, reduce the blood pressure. So you want something that's very kind of soothing music, you know, as opposed to kind of, you know, something sort of more rah-rah upbeat for the more of a depressed mood.
What about stopping thought? You know, people that have constant negative thoughts, you hear about being in the moment. Do you have some suggestions? Because, you know, if you have ADHD, that's what I keep telling that woman, get in the moment. She has no idea what I'm talking about because she can't stop the thought.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The attentional problem makes it hard for somebody to use some of those techniques. But what I have experienced, actually many times, is that guided imagery works better for a lot of people, and surely for people with attentional problems it does. And guided imagery is about being in the moment, but it's a tool. Like, I have created a number of guided imagery CDs. The first one, you could order it on Amazon now through this Stop Anxiety Now kit, but it won't be actually shipping until the spring. But there are other people that create a lot of these CDs, and, you know, Belarus Naprostek is one who, you know, does a tremendous number of them. But what they are is often, you know, they're CDs that have a background music that's very soothing. It's you're aware of it, but it's not in your face when you listen. And then there's this series of voice over comments and suggestions that are basically designed to appeal to all the different senses. So you might say, you might feel, you might hear, you might just feel, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then there are sort of these suggestions that encourage you to maybe go here, maybe go there, maybe go there. And they have, you know, a different purpose, different ones, you know, so it's for anxiety reduction or whatever that it is, and the suggestions will be tied into that. But because it's a multi-sensory tool, and because you can go where your mind and your body wants to go with it, what tends to happen is it affects serotonin and other neurotransmitters in a way similar to some medicines. And it's easier to do than certain other techniques that just ask you to focus on your breath or stay in the moment. Because a lot of people's minds won't do that. They won't stay there. And it turns out that with these kind of tools, the guided imagery tools, if you use one that, you know, speaks to you, you may listen to it and do the exercise for 8 or 10 minutes, but the result will stay with you for about 20 hours. So they're really powerful.
That's amazing. And tell us again where you can get those things.
Well, Belarus Naprostek, you can get through her website. It's healthjourneys.com. The one that I've just created for Hay House, you can pre-order on Amazon, and it's called Stop Anxiety Now.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and it's incredibly, incredibly powerful. So that's a wonderful mind-body tool for lots of different kinds of struggles, and it's not hard to do. And, you know, you have to buy a CD or something, but you can use it over and over and over again, and it can make a tremendous difference.
I would imagine that running to do, I mean, for some reason I feel the need to say that.
Yeah.
You must put forth the effort to do these things, and even if you have ADHD, you've got to put notes up or something and put forth the effort. It's not magic and doesn't appear one time. Right?
Well, it depends what you mean by put forth the effort. With something like this,
time to do
with
it.
The guided imagery, of course you have to do it. but it's fairly effortless. In other words, while you're listening to it, there's no work involved.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to make the 10-minute time and space, obviously be in a physical space where you're not going to be interrupted, where you don't have to rush. But beyond that, if you make the time and you just put the darn thing in your CD player, actually, it's very little effort. Unlike some other things where you have to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is very effortless. But obviously, you have to get the CD, you have to make the time, and you got to put it in. If you don't do it, it doesn't work.
I would imagine, too, that it could potentially help things like the diseases that you get from these stressors, like fibromyalgia and
yes,
things like that.
Absolutely. It does. And Belarus, for example, has created some different CDs for those specific conditions. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how long would it take before they'd get some symptom relief?
Oh, you get it right away.
From the fibromyalgia?
From the pain and the discomfort, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, is depression and these ADHD things, are they always genetic, or can they be developmental throughout your life?
Well, there's always a genetic contribution. I mean, our genetic contribution is about how vulnerable we are. With ADHD, the genetic contribution is very substantial. And I say that because there's a very heavy incidence within families. you know, there, it's not, if one a parent has it, there's a 50% chance that the kid will have it. So there's a pretty heavy genetic component to it. Mm-hmm. Now, can you have it and not have parents that have it? Probably. And are there things that can go on even in the development in the uterus that might affect the brain and make one person more vulnerable to it than another, no matter what their genes are? Probably, yes.
My kids have it terrible, and I don't have it, and my husband does it, and it just drives me crazy.
Okay, so it could be that, you know, you were carrying it but not expressing it. In other words, it's in your genes but not expressed for you. And it could be that that's true for him, too. And it could also be that, you know, during the course of development, not that you did something, but just, you know, we don't know all the things that affect even the way our diets that are we think are good or who knows what's in, you know what I mean, all kind of things. It could be that there are other things that are happening in utero and in early stages of life that affect what genes get expressed later. So, you know, it's interesting. We, you know, there used to be so much more focus on, you know, this nature versus nurture. You know, how much is genes and how much is upbringing. But what we're coming to understand more and more and more, first of all, is that they're interconnected. But even more than that, that gene expression, what the gene actually is going to do, is affected by every moment of its development from the time the egg and sperm meet. And so all kinds of things that might happen during the course of a pregnancy or what you might go through or what a child might experience in some early years, not that you did to them, but just like at the micro level, can affect what genes get expressed and how they get expressed. And, you know, this has to do with even probably things in our food supply. You know, like we aren't probably eating, you know, many, many more things in our regular diet that, you know, animals and so on that have been treated with hormones and antibiotics and all kinds of other stuff that, you know, a generation before wasn't in the food supply.
Right.
You know, that's just one example. But so what does that mean in terms of what you and I are doing when we're pregnant? You know, I have four children, right? So what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of our bodies? What does that mean in terms of what might be happening to the developmental process and to gene expression later in life? We don't know, but I'm sure it has something to do with it.
What do you think about EMS fields and heavy metals with regard to depression and things like ADHD?
Well, I don't know enough about it. I mean, I think that definitely there's a very, very strong genetic component to you know, contributions, shall we say, in ADHD. And there's a fairly strong one with depression, especially bipolar depression. But might a series of other things be contributing? Yeah, I don't know what, for sure. I mean, I don't think we know. But I'm open to the likelihood that, you know, a lot of things that we're doing to our physical environment to make it not so great affect us in ways we don't understand.
I lost my train of thought. She had a question.
Well, you're doing good so far.
There's something I wanted to ask you that just flew out the window for a second. I wanted to know, can you recommend any supplements, natural supplements, that help people sleep or help anxiety levels that, so that they, you know, can just take them as they need it, as opposed to something that they need constantly?
All right. The best things for sleep are good sleep hygiene, not supplements, first of all. The vast majority of us don't sleep well for some other reasons. I mean, obviously, if we're dealing with a clinical depression or a severe anxiety problem or whatever, it can affect our sleep, you know, or some other physical health conditions. But aside from that, the vast majority of us aren't sleeping well because of other things we're doing. We're not allowing adequate time. We do a lot of things close to bed that are energizing to our system. Most of us drink way too much or take it in other ways because it's in a lot of other medicines, caffeine. And many people will be significantly affected in their sleep ability by caffeine early in the day. Now, this is a striking thing, especially when you think about the growing number of places like Starbucks, which, by the way, I personally enjoy going to. But it's become much more of a way of life for us, and many, many medicines and many drinks, you know, sports drinks and all this other stuff, have a tremendous amount of caffeine in them. So this is actually a very, very significant contributor to a lot of the sleep difficulty that we see. Mm-hmm. And another one is sort of the frenetic life that we keep. So some of the things that actually are the most helpful in settling our systems is allowing for sort of calm and relaxing time before bed, darkening the room, minimizing caffeine, and also fluid intake close to bedtime so you don't wake up a lot. Mm-hmm. Not doing your, you know, heavy workout, I mean your aerobics or whatever you do, within a couple of hours of going to sleep. Not eating a heavy meal close to bedtime. A lot of these things, if we begin to shift them right away, shift our ability to sleep. And I do have concern about the degree, not that we should never use other interventions, because I recommend them and prescribe them, mm-hmm. but I have a concern about the degree to which we're often looking to, what should I take into my system to enable something to shift? And we oftentimes don't need to put something in. Sometimes we need to look at what we already put in,
right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that enough. And oftentimes people don't have an awareness of the degree to which things that they're doing affect their system's ability to settle.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, we've got about 4 minutes. Is there something that you would like to cover that I haven't covered that you think is important?
Well, I think what I would most like to make sure to say is that, you know, my mission and my passion really is about helping every one of us, you know, because we're all in this soup together,
mm-hmm.
Learn how to do the best job in our own self-care. And at the end of the day, each one of us is ultimately responsible for our own health and wellness. And I think you were saying something about that earlier, even when you said, you know, you have to make the time or you have to do it. And if we're given enough tools and we're given enough guidance and we're given enough direction, which is what my passion is about, then we really can learn how to do that. And, you know, in this most recent book, 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life, what I'm really working to do is give people the tools and the self-assessment ability and all kinds of suggestions and examples of things that they can do to kind of pick their best bag of solutions or best bag of interventions to make their lives work. And I believe we can all do it. I really do.
Well, I've read both of the books. Your publisher sent them to me, and they're great. I really
thank you.
The checklist and the charts that you gave, and I just really thought it was a good job, so I recommend it to everybody. Just
well, thank you very
much. Go and pick one up, and especially the 10 steps.
Well, the 10 steps is much more of a, here's how to think about it, here's examples, here's some ways to assess, here's what to do. So it's very, very nuts and bolts practical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need. We need practical solutions.
Absolutely. We're in a too hectic of a world.
Huh? Oh, man.
Well, listen, thanks for being with me. You were great.
Oh, it was a true delight, really. And I love what you're doing.
Thanks a lot. I hope you'll come back one day.
I'd be delighted to do that.
And agape to you.
Same.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.